So welcome to the first class on writing the history of the First World War. What is historiography? What is history? Etc. And so, although you will learn some things about the First World War, the objective is not to get you to be able to list the battles in the correct order and say why the Germans won in April and lost in July. Okay, that's not what we're doing. Really, the question is more: what is history, and what does it mean to write history? Now, seeing that you had obligatory history in 6e, 5e, 4e, 3e, you could justifiably be a little annoyed to come to university and have the teacher saying, "Oh, what is history? We're not very sure." But that might be the situation, and certainly there has been a long development of the view of what is history. Now, of course, history is writing about the past, but as you realise, it's quite impossible to write everything about the past. If we just take today, if you imagine forward 20 years' time and you want to write the history of today in Rouen, well, you have a million people doing a million things with different opinions about what they do. You have a huge amount of writing going on. You know, perhaps that the historian has found your notes, but not yours. And just obviously so much information that selection is the beginning of history. You have to select, and so you have to ask questions like what is important, and what constitutes a historical fact, and not just an accidental fact. So when I was trying to decide what history was, I was just the other day in the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. Now, I thought that would be a good place to find out about history. It used to be a railway station, a 19th century railway station. The railway transformed the 19th century, and there was a monument, a cathedral to the railway. And inside the Musée d'Orsay, there is all the 19th century arts. So obviously this is a choice of what people have considered valuable that needs preserving about the 19th century. So I thought if I went in there, I might find out what was history. And I came across this art. You can see that's the name, history. Yeah. So this is apparently what it is. And it's not tremendously helpful, really, is it? You know, you've got is this a woman or a man with their back to us? I think it's a woman, but I'm not absolutely sure. Here is a woman who's thinking about what to write. So maybe she's writing history, maybe she's writing history. And I don't know what this gentleman is doing in the background. Or in fact, I don't even know if he's a gentleman or just a man. But there you go. So that was not very helpful. Let's have a look then at the First World War. The reason I've chosen the First World War is not just because it's my own speciality, but also because it is one of the three or four world history events which has been the most written about. Probably the only competitor is the French Revolution. And so let's see what sort of things come up. Of course, history is not just history books. Documentaries, novels, and films all show us things about our past which may be more or less true. You even get unusual links to history with a series like Game of Thrones, which is obviously not supposed to be history, but in fact all of these symbols come from what we imagine to be the Middle Ages. There's been some very interesting work done on that. Now, I don't know if any of you seen Au revoir là-haut, the film that came out a couple of weeks ago about the First World War. Has anybody seen this one, War Horse? Yeah, this was a particular choice of the view of history. Let's take the point of view of a horse. Yeah. That was what one view. Sold millions of tickets. Please come and welcome. Sold millions of tickets. There it is in French, Cheval de Guerre. Other films have also been very, very successful. It's quite a successful area. Gallipoli with Mel Gibson. Also, because it is the centenary, there's been quite a lot of arguments about the First World War, and this here you can see an extract from the BBC News magazine a couple of years ago. Lions and Donkeys, 10 Big Myths About World War One, debunked, that is to say, shown to be false. Yeah? So they've taken 10 myths about the First World War, and they're showing why they believe they are untrue. And the first one in Britain because we're talking about the British historiography. The first one in Britain is the question of lions and donkeys. Does anybody understand this lions and donkeys thing? Yeah. Well, one critic of the government many years ago said in the First World War, the British Army is a pack of lions led by donkeys. Yeah, so this person, obviously it's a metaphor, said that the ordinary soldiers were lions full of courage and activity and dynamism, but their leaders, the generals, were donkeys who have forth the reputation of being stupid. So lions and donkeys. Lions and donkeys often appears at the centre of popular debates about the First World War in Britain. Is it true that they were lions led by donkeys, or is it not true? And quite often the historian has to come in and say, is that the best question? And that very often the job of a historian is let's have another think about the question. Yeah, because the people have answers before they have thought about the question. So the BBC News, lions and donkeys. Much of what we think about the 1914-18 conflict is wrong. Yeah, so what you thought is wrong. Of course, this is a normal discourse of popular journalism. Yeah? Yeah? Why what you think is wrong? That sells books, doesn't it? If it's an article that says, let me tell you why everything you think already is right, well, you don't need to read it. There's no need to read it. But this debate continued, and here you can see the reply of an anti-war organisation in Britain, again for the centenary, because the debate came up with the centenary, and this organisation is called No Glory in War. It was established in 2012, 2013, and it's a very, I will be talking more about it, it's a very original kind of campaign, because normally you have the official view and then individuals who say, I don't agree. And it's rather unusual to actually have a campaign saying, you know, for the centenary, the most important thing for this campaign is we don't want any glorifying of the war. And so here you have the reply, lions and donkeys. Dan Snow's 10 myths about World War I debunked. So they're replying to Dan Snow, the man who wrote the other article, and said, no, you're wrong. Yeah. So another 10 mistakes he made. Yeah. And so the debate, 100 years later, the debate is still very lively. The debate is still very lively. So let's have a look at the point of view then of the historian. This is the commentary. The point of view of the historian. Well, first of all, you need to, if you want to write a history book, you need to think about what questions would be important to you. And I wrote one history book about the First World War. I don't recommend writing a lot of them. It's very tiring. But people often ask me interesting questions while I was writing it. And one of the things they often commented is hasn't everything been written about the First World War? So I said, I explained how it works, that when you're a university professor and you write a book, you're obliged to write a book about a subject which has not been treated. You're not allowed to write another book about a subject that someone's written about. So, for example, if there's already a book about the newspapers in Glasgow and how they reacted to the First World War, you're not allowed to write another one. Well, you can if you like, but you won't get the job as professor. And many people said, oh, that must be very difficult to find a subject which has not been dealt with. And I thought it was a very interesting comment. And of course, absolutely opposite is the case. Yeah, 1/1000th of the possible books about the First World War have been written. That there's always a new question to find. And this is what we will be looking at, how people found new questions, questions they didn't know existed. For example, if I think of the postcards, postcards were extremely popular in the First World War, of course. People didn't know how to use Facebook. So they were obliged to send postcards. Every day, millions of postcards were sent with pictures on the front. And they were produced by very small publishing companies who sold postcards to make a living. And one day, a historian said, oh, well, if we look at the pictures, perhaps we can find out something about people's attitudes, people's fantasies, and so on. And so what he'd actually done is he'd invented a new historical question. What do postcards show about popular attitudes of the time? And when you want to write a new book, in fact, you need to find a new question. And nobody had said anything about this before, because everybody had imagined postcards, who cares? Postcards are not very important, are they? They're little details. Okay, well, when we look at the First World War, we found that, as I was saying, it is particularly well populated. And if I have a look at this, which is Amazon, is this UK? No, this is Amazon in France. And you can see that I've looked for the expression Première Guerre mondiale, which in English is First World War. Just checking. Okay, and you can see here the important information, yes? Yeah, how many new books this month? Yeah, we've got 5 new books this month. And in total, 31 children's books about the First World War, 1,600 history books, and so on and so forth. So, the first problem you have with the First World War is there are so many books. And if you look in Britain, the situation is all even more plethoric, because in the last 30 days, this is last year's slide, but the situation hasn't changed. In the last 30 days, 40 new books on the First World War. 40 books in 30 days. Yeah. So it's actually impossible. If you read only that, you actually can't keep up. Fortunately, many of the books are not as new as they appear to be. For example, you have a book about the 1st Lancashire Regiment and a book about the 2nd Lancashire Regiment. You don't need to read the book about the 3rd Lancashire Regiment because it will be saying similar things. And again, here, 551 children's books. Yeah. If you have a big sister or a big brother who has children you don't like, you can buy them 551 books about the First World War. And that should sort them out. No, I'm only joking. And the number one, the bestseller, the number one, John Keegan's classic book on the First World War. So what can you do with this enormous amount of literature to understand, this is my aim in these weeks, is to understand, looking at this mass of writing, to understand what does that say about the different kinds of history that can be written. How do you judge a history book? Now, we will only be talking about the First World War, but it's exactly the same if you have a book about the history of Catalonia, for example, to take an example at random. I was already mentioning the excess of information that we have, that immediately you look at any historical... I look at the specialist newspapers of popular music in the First World War, the newspapers that were produced for the singers and the managers and so on. And just it's very, very specialised. And there is an issue, there are 32 pages every week of just this one newspaper, so huge amounts. And people have already thought about, in the past, about this question of what can you do with too much information. And a famous Edwardian intellectual, I think, Lytton Strachey, she said the following: the history of the Victorian age will never be written. We know too much about it. Now, he wasn't joking. He was obviously being a little bit ironic, but he wasn't joking. He was saying that really that because the Victorian age had more information than previous ages, that made it that made the job harder for the historian. This is absolutely true. If you want to study monks in the north of France in the 9th century, then you will probably find that there are, I don't know, a few hundred manuscripts, and that's it. And some archaeology, and that's it. But of course, the Victorian age, after the invention of the printing, every day you have a million pages. And so he was arguing about that. And this is exactly, more specifically, what he said concerning the age which has just passed. Because he's writing at the beginning of the 20th century. Our fathers and our grandfathers have poured forth and accumulated so vast a quantity of information that the industry of our Ranke, the great German historian, would be submerged by it, and the perspicacity of a Gibbon, the great historian who wrote the history of Rome, an Englishman who wrote the history of Rome, would quail before it. It is not by the direct method of a scrupulous narration that the explorer of the past can hope to depict that singular epoch. So, Lytton Strachey says, scrupulous narration is no longer a good idea. scrupulous narration. That means, you know, on January the 1st, this is what happened. On January the 2nd, this is what happened. Yeah, that it's no longer possible to get anywhere like that. If he is wise, he will adopt a subtler strategy. He will attack his subject in unexpected places, like postcards. He will fall upon the flank or the rear. He will shoot a sudden revealing searchlight into obscure recesses hitherto undivined. And in all modesty, this is what I have tried to do when I wrote about popular song in the First World War. Previously, popular song had been considered to be an amusing illustration of society, and I've been trying to fight for it to be considered not as as a reflection of history, but as a part of history. And I hope to show you more about that. There you go, Lytton Strachey, eminent Victorians in 1918. When you look at a history book and you want to judge not just is it good or is it bad, but what is it trying to do, then you have a series of questions that you have to ask. And these are also for the people especially who are thinking of doing research. These are also questions which you have to ask yourself. Well, the very first one is, what sources? Yeah, what sources were used? And for the first, for at least half an hour, I'm going to look at a series of sources, and perhaps you will be able to help me with this. The second question, which we all would normally tend to ask, at least us intellectuals like to ask this question, is what corpus? Now, what's the difference between sources and a corpus? Do you know the difference between sources and a corpus? It's very similar, isn't it? If you have a corpus, you have sources. If you have a corpus, you have sources, but if you have sources, you don't necessarily have a corpus. Anybody clear on what? Yeah. And not necessarily. No, a corpus could be songs or churches. If you have 1,000 churches that you're looking at, that could be a corpus. Yes. Yeah.
Corpus is something that you've realized,
That you've actually made.
Yeah.
Yes, that's, you're right. You're right there. Yeah, a corpus is a deliberately structured set of sources. Let me give you an example. Supposing you're studying, I don't know, women in the Second World War. And you read a lot of newspapers and you take, oh, there's an article that interests me about women. And you read some more newspapers, oh, there's an article. And you end up with 100 articles. And these are articles which you found interesting. These are sources, but this is not a corpus. Because why did you choose them? Because you found them interesting. Well, that's not very important, yeah. Now, if you choose, let's say, all the articles about women written by members of parliament, that's a corpus. It's a corpus because it's something structured that you can say, oh, yes, well, members of parliament typically think this, because you have all the articles written by members of parliament. Whereas the problem with the first imaginary source we got, the articles which you liked, you could say, oh, well, half of them say this. It proves nothing. Because you haven't shown that your source is representative. It's just your. Students often make this mistake. They say, oh, I found a lot of articles about this subject. But that's not good enough. You have to be able to structure it in some way. Anyway, but it has to be so that when you say something, you can say, ah, it's typical. So when I was looking at song, I managed to get a collection of 1,200 songs. And I know that there were only about 8,000 altogether. So I knew I had a fairly good corpus. And these were the most popular songs, the ones which appeared in the specialist press. Yeah. And so if, for example, when I look at these songs, I say, oh, there are no songs about hating Germans. If that's true in British music hall in the First World War, there are no songs about hating Germans. And I could say, oh, well, this is interesting because I know that my corpus represents typical songs, and it's not just ones I have chosen. That's a slightly difficult distinction between sources and corpus, but keep thinking about it. You can't just have sources. You know, of course, you need original sources, but that's not enough. You need to have a selection which means something. If you're in popular music, this is very difficult because there's so much of it. Yeah? You know, this year, there were, 5,000 new songs this year. What can you do with that? But you could, for example, choose songs released in the first week of December every year over the last 10 years. That would be a random corpus, but that would allow you to compare them. We will come back to this question. Our third, and perhaps the most important, is what questions is the historian asking? Because there should always be questions. Now, obviously, you don't ask questions like, who won the First World War? Because that's a question of fact and not of interpretation. But we will be seeing throughout the whole set of seminars what questions. Becoming a historian is inventing new questions. For example, until not so long ago, the experience of housewives, of women who didn't go out to work for money, but people who worked, women who worked at home looking after the family, there were very, very few history books about this, because everybody agreed that this was not important. The things they were doing were not important. And the people who came in and said, hey, maybe it is important, let's see what we can find out about it. One of my colleagues in England last year wrote a piece about listening to music in the home. Now, this was quite new. There are many books about concerts. There are many books about records. And listening to music in the home in the 1920s. And you realise that we don't know a lot about what people did with music in the home in the 1920s. Most of them did not have record players. They were very expensive. Yeah. So you're talking about pianos, musical evenings for the middle class, and sing songs for the working class. Yeah. Different atmospheres. So new questions, finding new questions. Every historian has methods. All kinds of methods are possible. Statistical methods. You can take, you know, all the songs released in December over the last 30 years, and you can say, in the 1980s, 17% were love songs. And in the years 2000, only 7%. I don't know, I invented these statistics. But that would be a statistical method in the counting. You could have a method of literary analysis on the songs. You know, are they full of metaphors? Are they very poetic? Or on the contrary, are they very down to earth? Many of the songs of the First World War are very down to earth. It's, you know, I was walking along the road one day, and the three verses are three things which happened to him one after the other. Whereas this very straightforward structure of a song doesn't disappear, but it becomes much less popular after Bob Dylan and the Beatles say, hey, no, let's have contradictory voices all at the same time saying things which we half understand. Yeah, when modernism meets popular music. And there are many other methods which are possible. Of course, you can go and not for the First World War, but for the Second World War, you can go and interview people, go and interview old people. What was the Second World War like for you? That's another method, isn't it? What we call oral history. You can go and interview people. Every method has its own problems. When you're interviewing people, they might not tell you the truth. You noticed in the memoirs of the First World War, everybody remembers their friends being killed beside them. Nobody seems to remember killing anybody. In the memoirs, they don't write it. They must have killed somebody, or it wouldn't have been a proper war. Yeah, but of course, people select from their memories. And similar to previous things, what assumptions, what is considered to be obvious? In books about the First World War, very often what is considered to be obvious in British books about the First World War is that it's a good thing that Britain won. That Britain represented something more progressive. This is not my opinion, this is the general opinion. And finally, it's a similar idea, what is the objective? Historians always have an opinion. Even if they can say it or they can try to hide it, but they always have an opinion, and that's fine. How could you possibly have an objective history of today in 20 years' time? How could it be objective? Because you must initially select Okay, so let's say we're going to select people in the railway station and interview people in the railway station and find out about their lives, and that will be our selection. But that means we haven't talked to people who were at work or who stay at home, who never move, etc. Well, you're always selecting, so you can't be completely objective. Okay, so my first whole big section is about sources. And so let's see, first of all, what kind of sources would you imagine? So on the First World War, I'm working on primary sources on the First World War. Don't say songs, because I already told you that. But what kind of sources would you expect to different historians to be working on about the First World War? What comes to mind? Primary sources, yeah?
Newspapers.
Yeah, newspapers. Yeah, there's lots of newspapers. Most people in Britain can read. Primary education became obligatory in 1870. So that's 40 years before. So now most people can read. There are popular newspapers. The Daily Express. There are political newspapers, the Daily Herald. You know, there's a lot of newspapers around, so that certainly would be a very rich resource. They can be quite hard to understand for us today. You really, they can be quite hard. Not because the language has changed, but because, of course, they don't explain the things which everybody knows. The references to stars you've never heard of. So it can be quite difficult. More primary sources for the First World War.
Photographs
are difficult to find at the time. They're expensive. There are two different kinds of technology in photographs at the time. One of them is rather old-fashioned, and you have to get everybody to, can you stay exactly still for a minute and a half and I'll take your photograph? And this is of course problematic, because it means you can't get photographs of people in the railway station or people in the streets, because everybody has to pose. But there is a new technology just coming out, which is actually not so heavy, not this big, and you can actually take photographs. And this is why we get some photographs of the battlefields. The soldiers are not allowed to carry cameras with them, because if they are captured by the enemy, the photographs could be useful to the enemy. But of course, soldiers are soldiers, and so they don't always obey. And so we do have photographs. More primary sources of the First World War. Letters. Yeah, people wrote a lot of letters. And the people who couldn't write, because of course, you know, most people could write, but it wasn't that unusual. More in France. Remember, France is a more peasant country. Not as many people writing at the time. I will come back to that. People wrote a lot of letters. And if they couldn't write, they would ask the priest or the vicar to write for them. Or the nurse, could you write a letter to my mother for me? I'll tell you what to say. And these can be, of course, quite complicated sources. We'll come back to that as well. Any more primary sources for the First World War? Yes?
I'm thinking about the government, especially propaganda. Is it really relevant?
Government propaganda. So this could be reports or communiques. And indeed, the government produces an awful lot of prints. In Britain, parliamentary debates are published every day. Everything which is said in Parliament is published. I can't remember the date when they began to do this. But that's Hansard. So that would obviously be a good idea. It's also, the parliamentary debates are a good source, because everything is written down. And these days, of course, today, it's much easier than 20 years ago, because you have text search. You can search for a particular word. Whereas before you had to say, oh, I wonder what they say about Manchester. Yeah, 3,000 pages later. More primary sources on the First World War. Yep. Not anymore, but in the past, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, everybody who took part in the First World War is now dead. But in the 60s and 70s, they did do quite a lot of interviews. And in the British Library in London, there are a few thousand hours of interviews. So that's certainly true. Now, that gets a little bit complicated as a question, because some people would say that these are not primary sources. Because 50 years later, what do you remember about the time? Firstly, people forget. Secondly, people lie. Thirdly, people select. I'm old, so I can promise you that we always have a rosy view of You know, 40 years ago, I was more handsome. I had more success with the ladies. You know, 40 years ago was a wonderful time. And everybody thinks like this. Everybody finds the past. It tends to make it look nicer, you know. You know that all your parents think that the music when they were young is better than the music when you were young. Whereas, of course, this is absolutely not the case. The opposite is the case. Okay, that's a good start. Let's see what I have here. Here's my first kind of... These are kinds of sources. What is it? It's a map. Who made it? Yes, certainly military in any case. Is it a German map? I should have looked at it before. 6th, 2nd, 20th. No, it's in English. It's in English. It is a military map, indeed. It's a military map. So you have to make these every week. You have to make these every week to show where everybody is, you know, and pass them and keep them secret as well. Yeah. And so here you have these are indeed the Germans, but here it might be German because this is German and this is English. But you're right that these big green arrows, it looks like a German map, doesn't it? Because the Germans are big green arrows. Yeah, it looks very, very, very positive. Yeah, military maps and military reports are produced in large numbers and might allow you to answer questions like, why was this battle won by the Germans? Why was this battle won by the French? So here, these are very specific kinds of questions. Of course, these maps will not tell you how did the soldiers feel about not being able to go on holiday. Yeah. So you choose your source, you also choose your question to some extent. The maps, of course, may be inaccurate. They may be dishonest. You can sometimes allow soldiers to be taken prisoner with false maps. It's an old trick. If you organize a war, remember that. Okay, you never know. Military reports and maps. Second kind of source. This is what you mentioned, in fact. This is a government pamphlet. In fact, this is a government pamphlet. Now, is it a propaganda pamphlet? That's often a matter of opinion. Because, of course, I am explaining and you are making propaganda. Yeah, so here we have a very famous report of the Committee on Alleged German Outrages appointed by His Britannic Majesty's Government and presided over by the Right Honourable Viscount Bryce, etc. So this is they set up a committee on alleged German outrages, what we would call today, in modern language, war crimes. It's a fascinating story of why they did this, because what they did was there were huge numbers of rumours about what the Germans did in Belgium. And some of them were true and some of them were false. It's generally accepted today that most of them were false. And they often said more about the people who believed them than about the things. So for example, there's, oh yes, the Germans invaded this village and they cut off the breasts of all the little girls. That kind of story. They were very, very common stories. One of the problems for the British government is that people were not believing them. And so they establish a committee to write a report, and this report will say, of course, there are a few which were made up, but they were essentially true. So this is very important. So this is an arm for the government to maintain civilian morale. The First World War is a total war. And so the determination of the population, of the civilian population, is essential. And so there will be a continual battle to encourage people to do more for the war. And of course, if you think, well, the Germans are not so bad, you might do less for the war. And so this is government pamphlets, government publications. And I mentioned that the Houses of Parliament, I think this is the House of Lords, isn't it? The House of Parliament publishes everything which is said in every debate. So government reports and parliamentary debates. I'm sorry, this, as you, of course, you have recognised, is the Canadian Parliament. I recognise because it's written here. Okay. Government reports and parliamentary debates. There's a primary source. You can do a lot with that. It's not finished. the parliamentary report, the parliamentary debates of the 4 years, 4.5 years of the war, you could still today find new questions which have not been answered and use that source if you wanted to. Yeah. For example, I'm sure that regularly they talk about women. How? Remember, of course, all the members of Parliament are men. How do they talk about women during the war in Parliament? I don't know, but that's a reasonable idea for research. It could be done. So even a very old source which has been much studied, you can find a new question. Another source. Can you see what that is? Yes, you can. What is it? Yeah, I hope somebody has good eyes, better than mine anyway. Yeah, it's a medical certificate, sometimes, of course, they write up medical certificates to say whether if the soldier is too ill to fight, yeah, he gets a medical certificate. And sometimes, of course, they burn them at the end of the year. But sometimes they don't. And many years later, you have the collection, the archive, and some historian will be happy. Historians are not like ordinary human beings. Yeah, okay, some of the historians would be happy. For example, how ill did you need to be to escape military service? At the beginning, not very ill. At the end of the war, they were desperate for soldiers, and more and more very ill people were accepted into the army. To such an extent, at one point, the leaders of the army were complaining to the government, you're sending us people we can't use. You're sending us people who the doctors should have refused. So the medical. The other thing which is absolutely fascinating is that there are certain kinds of disability or certain kinds of condition which make it impossible to fight, which are not the object of consensus among the medical corps. So, for example, the categories often used today, bipolaire. Traumatisme détresse post-traumatique. Of course, these things didn't exist. Interestingly enough, during the war, the view of psychological conditions changed. For the first 2 years, it was generally considered by the army doctors that people who said, I am too nervous or psychologically disturbed to fight, were cowards. End of story. If you shoot 1 in 10 of them, they'll be okay. The rest of them, yeah. And gradually, they were more or less obliged to accept some kind of psychological explanations for not being able to fight. It has to be said that you had some extreme situations where men would lose the power of speaking. Because they've just been so. This is still being studied. One top historian said recently, what we have not understood is that shell shock, that is the trauma, psychological trauma, was not exceptional. No, it was universal in the First World War. Now, this is an opinion, not a fact. It's difficult to prove, but that he's working on that idea that in fact. And certainly there are some reasons to think it is true. For example, in the 60s, they found that what was typical of old soldiers from the First World War is that they had never told their story to anybody. That was typical. A few soldiers gave their story. Most soldiers said nothing, not even to their family. It was impossible to talk about. Also, in the First World War, it has to be said there was a particular view of men and women's roles in society. So men considered that it would be unfair to talk to women about war because it was their job was to keep that pain to themselves, yeah? Which is no fun. Hey, it's not fair. Okay, medical records. So I'm hoping that we will see little by little that there are a large number of sources, and they each have their typical questions, but they also each have their typical problems, the things which are missing, the things which you can easily misinterpret. Letters. Somebody mentioned letters. Lots of things you can get from letters. Here you can see that the letter is written on YMCA notepaper. You know, the YMCA organized little clubs Not on the battlefield, that's a bad idea, but just behind when they had a week's rest. And they would give cigarettes and writing paper, and if people couldn't write, they would write the letter for them. And that was a major service, and the soldiers loved the YMCA because they were doing this for them. And you can see the YMCA were not neutral. For God, for King, and for Empire. Ça mérite la clarté. These were not pacifists, and so on and so forth. And there's a lot you can find about. A lot you can find not just from the content of the letters, but also, and this is important, that when you find a primary source, you have two kinds of information you can get from it. You can get information which was deliberately put in. For example, this person is writing to their mother or whatever, and you can say, oh, well, what were they writing to their mother? And you can get that out. But also, sometimes you can get accidental information. For example, how many were written in the YMCA? From the handwriting, you could probably tell which were written by the soldiers, working class people, and which were written for them by the generally bourgeois volunteers. Also, if it is feminine handwriting, then it's probably written by the nurse for a soldier who can't write or who has lost an arm. So in any primary source, you can get from it information which was deliberately put in there, but also information which you accidentally find. And that's always handy. People say things they didn't mean to say. And I have an example here. This is a letter from Lieutenant Thomas, so a lieutenant, he was an officer, and one of the things we often underestimate today is how undemocratic society was 100 years ago. And for example, in Britain, if you went to a private school, and we're talking about the boys here because girls are not important in 1914, sorry. If you went to a private school, you were automatically an officer. You don't have to pass an exam or anything, or get a diploma, you automatically become an officer because they consider that if you went to a private school, you're part of the class which is born to rule. And if you went to an ordinary school, and probably left school at 14, I'm sorry, but you're an ordinary soldier because that's life. And this is not, whereas today, of course, this would be very shocking today, because the democratic spirit, despite all our problems, has made considerable progress. At the time, that was automatic. When officers were wounded, they went to the officers' hospital. And when soldiers were wounded, they went to the soldiers' hospital. And I think you can imagine that one of the hospitals was more comfortable than the other one. You get some even more shocking things. The national newspaper, The Times, every Sunday, they wrote a list of all the officers who were killed. But not about the soldiers. Anyway, we'll see more of this. Here is a letter from the officer. I could not describe the horrors of it on paper. Our colonel was a wonder to see. He had absolutely no fear, and I followed him and helped him all I could in every charge, but he was blown to pieces in the end by a shell. We had, I think, 10 officers killed, 5 wounded, and the remainder prisoners. I was wounded in 2 places, a bullet right through my throat, and all the biceps of my left arm blown away by a piece of shell, but no bones broken. Well, that's all right, then. My throat, of course, is very bad and very troublesome. They put in a tube so as to allow me to breathe, and I can eat and drink all right, but I can't speak at all. The Germans are really very good to us prisoners, and the doctors seem to be very clever. So there is really nothing to complain about. I love that there's nothing to complain about. Although, that's very British, and it's also very Edwardian. Very Edwardian, that if you think today that men don't know how to talk about their feelings, you should have tried the Edwardian times. That was even worse. What is the information here in the first paragraph, which you can find that he isn't saying? What can you get from the first paragraph reading between the lines? 10 officers were killed, 5 officers were wounded, and the remainder were taken prisoners. What happened to the soldiers who were not officers? We don't know. Why don't we know? Because he doesn't care. It's not important information. He's not going to tell you how many men were killed. Who cares? Yeah. So in fact, you can see that is information which he didn't intend to put in the letter, but is in fact the truth. You look like you wouldn't have enjoyed the First World War. No, it was a pretty bad deal. I have to say, My wife is fed up to there with the First World War, because she has to reread my articles in French to correct the French, and she never wants to hear a word about the First World War again. You only get one set of seminars, so that's not so bad. The letters are also present today in the centenary, because for the first section of these seminars, I'll be talking about the history of the war, and then in the last section, I'll be talking about memory and commemoration. And what does that mean, and where does it come from? And in both cases, we will try to avoid the conclusion that people have done things in a particular way because they're more stupid than we are. Yeah, we're not paid to conclude that people are stupid. This is where I got the letter from. This is a company, an insurance company, and on their website today, they have put a set of letters from their employees 100 years ago. And so they're kind of proud that their company was involved in this 100 years ago. So it's a rather interesting example of commemoration there. So you can see, normally they're interested in investment, corporate responsibility, but they're also interested in the heritage of this insurance company and what their employees did in World War I. Okay, so much for letters. What kind of this is not really a very good example. Let's look at the other one. Diaries is an obvious primary source. It also should be said that this is not really, this is the wrong word here. In fact, it's a diary. This says memoir on the cover. It's not a memoir. A memoir is something you write afterwards. Yeah. And a diary is something you write day to day. And of course, they're very different from a historian's point of view. As you realize from time to time, I don't know if people of your generation kept diaries, but if you find a diary that you wrote when you were 12 and you read it, it's full of things, apart from the embarrassing things, it's full of things which you've forgotten. And if you wrote today about when you were 12, it would be different. It would be very different. So this source is, in fact, diaries written at the time. And to be strict, and we need to be strict because we're being historians, then you need to make this big distinction between a memoir and a diary. Important distinction. These are two of the most interesting diaries written at the time. One of the difficulties with diaries is that middle class people and people from the bourgeoisie write more diaries 100 years ago than working class people who are less educated. And so one of the difficulties we had for a while is that we had lots of diaries from officers and almost no diaries from ordinary soldiers. And so if you studied diaries, you didn't get a neutral view. Because, of course, in reality, the officers are about 10% of the army. This is no longer the case. There are now quite a number of diaries from ordinary soldiers. And these are still being discovered. This is literally the case. Hey, my grandfather died. Not mine. Somebody says, my grandfather died, and I had to empty his house. I hope you're too young to have this experience. It's horrible. And I found a diary from his father about the First World War. People are still finding them today, and because it's the centenary, they're then going, and also people now have the internet, so oh, who will publish a diary? Before the internet, this was impossible to know. Do you know any publishers? No, me neither. Yeah. Whereas now, and so people are publishing, every year there are new diaries being published, but these two are particularly interesting, because this one is by a man who joined the army, who didn't want to join the army. The reluctant Tommy. Yeah, Tommy is the English word, which is the equivalent of the French poilu. So this is an interesting diary, because it's a diary of a man who joined the army, who didn't want to join the army, and who was rather sarcastic about the army. And this one is a wonderful diary, which is the diary of a rich woman who was at home, who stayed at home with her children, while her family her brothers and father were officers in the army, and she was very enthusiastic about the war. She thought it was a wonderful way of renewing the national fibre. This was not unusual at the time. A lot of people thinking that way, and we will come back to that. So diaries written at the time, and of course then their counterpart, which is to say, memoirs written later. Soldiers' memoirs written later. And there you have two of the most well-known soldiers' memoirs. The one by Robert Graves, Goodbye to All That. Robert Graves was a poet. And he wrote his memoir, Goodbye to All That, which was very controversial because he accused officers of horrible things. Yeah, he said that officers sometimes would just execute without a trial their soldiers. And this was very, very controversial because also it wasn't an academic book, so he didn't say this happened on the 4th of June in such a place. And so this became very controversial. And this one, Old Soldiers Never Die, is a fascinating memoir, not a diary, a memoir, because Frank Richards was a professional soldier before 1914. So he was a professional soldier. The British Army for the First World War was made up of three very different groups. Firstly, a small professional army, which was already existed in 1914, and who were rapidly, massacred really, in the first months of the war. Secondly, there was the volunteer armies, which between 1914 and 1916 were made up of at least a million people. They were volunteers at the beginning of the war. There was no conscription in Britain. And indeed, before the war in 1911, 1912, 1913, there was no military service in Britain. So very different from France. In France, all the men were part of the army on the 1st of August, 1914. Conscription, there was no argument about that. The first group, the professional soldiers. The second group, the volunteer soldiers. But it was not possible to get enough soldiers that way. Because people, once they started to see the terrible massacres, people didn't think it was such a wonderful idea. And so after 1916, there was conscription, and you received a letter telling you that you had to join the army. You could always ask for exemption. You could go to a local tribunal and say, no, I don't want to join the army because I'm the only person who can look after my old mother, or because I'm a pacifist and I want to be a conscientious objector. You would probably not succeed at the tribunal, but it was not impossible. It was not impossible to get. Frank Richards, Old Soldier Never Die, particularly interesting because a professional soldier, the stories of a professional soldier. Soldiers' memoirs written later. And here we're at a point where, is it a primary source? Is it a secondary source? It's somewhere between the two. Now, I know we work very hard on students making sure they know the difference between a primary source and a secondary source. And then the following year, of course, we tell them it's more complicated than that. This is university. Welcome to university. So soldiers' memoirs, they have elements of primary sources because they're written by the people who really lived. But they have elements of secondary sources because they may be remembering differently or wanting to present it in a particular way. Ordinary soldiers or officers are not the only people to write memoirs. Politicians and generals wrote memoirs, sometimes very long memoirs. There you have then the war memoirs of David Lloyd George, Volume 1 has disappeared, but there's volume 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, if you want to read them. Quite a lot, yeah? Lloyd George became Prime Minister halfway through the war. And quite understandably, when a politician or a general writes their memoirs, one of their main objectives is to justify what they did. Because, of course, the debate about the war continues for a long time after the war, and any general or politician can be criticised. You know, somebody says, we could have won the war in 1916 if the general so-and-so was not so stupid, you know. If you're a leader, it's always a good idea to put down your opinion on this. And later on, after the Second World War, Winston Churchill will write a long memoir, which is very influential. Although Winston Churchill will have a particular advantage in that he was actually a writer, whereas, of course, most people are not. Well, that's the first hour. We have 5 minutes break, and then we continue.